When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, I'm Phil Kitramalides and welcome to the Optus Sport Football Podcast. I'm joined this week, not by Mark Schwarzer, but by former Leeds United striker and no stranger to this podcast, Michael Bridges. Hello, Bridgie.
Great to see you, Phil. Good to be back. And you lose one big nose and you get another big nose. So, your lucky weekend.
I thought you were going to say big name, but yeah, nose works as well, I guess. We've also got football journalist Julien Laurent, another of our familiar faces on the Optus Sport Football Podcast. Hi, Jules.
Hello, boys.
Good to have you back. The headline today, obviously, Liverpool 1, Manchester City 1. It was billed as one of the biggest games in recent seasons, and it is still so, so tight at the top of the table after that 1-1 draw at Anfield. We've got 28 games played in the Premier League. Arsenal sit on 64 points. Liverpool are just behind them on goal difference, also on 64 points, and Manchester City have 63. We'll get to the why they are where they are in just a moment. But for now, a quick one-word answer, guys. Who wins the Premier League title from here? Bridgie?
Manchester City.
That's two words, Bridgie.
City.
Okay, Jules?
Arsenal.
And I will go for Liverpool, just to mix
Look at this.
I've been saying Liverpool for a few weeks now, so it would be silly of me to change my mind now. But yeah, all right, let's get to the discussion of the game. Liverpool 1, Manchester City 1. I was trying to rack my brains here. This is one of the best 1-1 draws I can remember. I mean, we can analyse parts of the game in just a moment. But firstly, I mean, just what a thrilling game it was to watch, Bridgie.
Absolutely incredible. If you're talking about like a draw 1-1, I mean, it was built up to be an incredible game anyway because of obviously both the teams going for the Premier League title and the relevance that Klopp coming up against Pep Guardiola probably for the last time in his career in the Premier League. I just thought the whole game, I mean, I didn't even move off the couch or the lounger and I was absolutely knackered watching it. It was so end-to-end, it was fast, it was furious, it was frantic, it had everything. And if you'd come and landed from a different planet and you landed and that was the first game of football that you watched, you'd be glued to it because you would be, now, I don't want to disappoint the person that came down on that craft, that alien aircraft, because football is not always like that. But what I loved was the respect that was shown at the end between both managers, both sets of players, because they realised how much of a good game of football that had been and that they'd basically gone toe-to-toe. And the other thing that I was absolutely blown away by, I've got to credit the Liverpool fans because I think if that had been at the Etihad, no disrespect to Manchester City fans, they would not have made that kind of noise that Liverpool fans generated inside that stadium. It came through on the TV screens. They whistled every time City had the ball and they were right behind their team from the start, and it was just an incredible game of football, Phil. And I was, like I say, I just think it put that match for the two best managers in Premier League at this moment in time on a pedestal, and it lived up to the expectations.
Who's happier with the result, Jules?
I have to be City, really, I think, because it's a point away from home. It's a game where, especially after the hour mark, they were heavily dominated by this Liverpool side that was great, that kept pressing and running and running and be more and more intense, which, I mean, Bridges is right. Watching it felt draining. So imagine if you're a City player. And I think people, it's not just the high press is great. A lot of people can run a lot and with a lot of intensity, all right? It's just imagine if you're the opposition and every time you have the ball, every time you try to build up from the back or you try to build an attack or build anything, and you know that every time there will be a red shirt around you, maybe two, maybe three, and you can't afford a one bad touch, a one overweight pass, nothing, because otherwise it will cost you. And we saw with Nathan Ake, because really that moment changed the game. 50th minute, straight after the break. I think had City maybe kept that one lead a bit longer, maybe Anfield wouldn't have been so rocking and etc. But that mistake by Ake, the penalty, the goal by McAllister changed the whole dynamic of what than we had from 50th until the end of the game.
And then it just seemed to be one-way traffic after that. Julian, I mean, Liverpool were just absolutely relentless, like you were talking about there. I was so impressed with the way they pressed, the way they wouldn't allow Manchester City to play through the lines. And every time they went long, it was easy. Haaland was coming far too short. They didn't have an outlet over the back. And it was, I just thought Jurgen Klopp got the tactics absolutely spot on, as he always seems to do when he comes up, you know, when they come up against each other. And I would love to think that a few teams and managers have watched that and gone, do you know what it is? Why do we just sit back on the edge of our penalty area when we play Manchester City and allow them to dictate play? If we can go and have a go at them in the final third and press, and I know it doesn't, it's not as easy as I'm trying to explain, because it takes a lot of hard work to press like that and a lot of understanding and a lot of work on the training ground. But surely some teams will think, do you know what it is? We're going to get beat if we sit back and defend anyway. Let's have a go at Manchester City, because it's the most vulnerable I have seen them. Like you say, Phil, Julian, they look shell-shocked. They couldn't have a breather, Manchester City. And then a player like De Bruyne getting taken off, having an argument with Pep about tactics. You know, Kovacic came on. I think he actually steadied the ship in that midfield to give Manchester City a bit more time on the ball and actually disrupted Liverpool for a little bit.
Guardiola explained that change, didn't he, afterwards? He said, I brought Kovacic on to have a bit more of the ball and have a bit more control. And he felt that it worked. Obviously, Kevin De Bruyne was not happy at all. He was sort of making some gestures when he went off. And then we saw the cameras focus in on Guardiola, who actually went and sit next to Kevin De Bruyne and kind of explained to him what had happened.
He just gave him a pep talk, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, he did. Yeah. I just wanted to also just put this result into context of, and I know every team has had, you know, lots of injuries, but I've got here a list of players that Liverpool had out for this game, and I might have missed some off, but Konate, Gravenberch, Diego Jota, Thiago Alcantara, obviously, Curtis Jones, Alisson Becker, Alexander Arnold, Joel Matip, I've missed some, Bacetic. I mean, there are so many. So to put in this kind of performance when the squad is kind of, I don't want to say on its last legs, but they're really down to the bare bones. And to be able to put that kind of energetic, intense performance with a threadbare squad, I guess gives it even more merit.
Yeah, massively. I think where Klopp was perfect, you would have, I mean, I think a lot of people maybe would have started Robertson at left back, right? Mm. Because he's back to full fitness now. He's been playing a bit. It's no problem. The thing is, if you start Gomez and Gomez does a decent job on Foden, which he kind of did, at times Foden had the better of him, but let's say that. Conor Bradley on the right, we've seen him now. He's clearly a very, very talented player. No problem. But then, if you can afford to bring on Robertson after an hour, like Klopp did, or after 50 minutes or half time, to go up and down that left-hand side, that's another headache for Pep to deal with. And I don't think they were ready for Robertson. And to be fair, Robertson had a massive impact on the game after coming on, because on the left-hand side, it looked like you had all those, we said, all that intensity from Liverpool. But then on top of that, all the changes or some of the substitutions that Klopp made had a massive impact, not just physically and in that intensity, but also bringing something different to the game. Robertson is a very different left back to Joe Gomez, obviously. And I just think that everything was perfect on that. But like we said, Pep responded quite well with Kovacic, who is very press resistant. He could have dropped De Bruyne a bit deeper, maybe instead of taking him off. But I thought the Kovacic change made a lot of sense.
Yeah, I agree with you, Julian. I think the when you look at the front, the midfield three of Liverpool and the front three of Liverpool, there's a lot of experience, there's a lot of quality there. Yeah, Salah's not involved, but Harvey Elliott, you know, he's at home, he's playing Man City, he ran his socks off as well, and he's a top-class player. The influence, the one that got me was Kwanzaa playing alongside Virgil van Dijk in such a big game up against Haaland. And what I thought was super impressive, after the game he got interviewed and he was stood next to Virgil van Dijk, and he wasn't happy with the result. He said, you know, we've let ourselves down. We didn't keep a clean sheet. We haven't won at home. And I was like, my word, this lad's come in and he's absolutely disappointed that he's just had a game against City and they've held him to a 1-1. And I just thought that is the mentality that Klopp brings to this team. And the other thing about the lads, you've mentioned Bradley, Kwanzaa, that Klopp gives them the respect to put them out there and the trust and the honesty to put a youngster in that situation as he's done. He's not scared to do that, and the players have repaid him in the best possible faith. And I think that is another thing that Liverpool have got in their armoury. They're not their youngsters that are coming through. Lee Clark's son is playing there as well. I knew him from a very young age when I was at Sunderland with Lee Clark in Newcastle. I've seen the lad develop, but you know, it's still, you've got to be faith. And the system that Liverpool have behind the scenes at all age groups, I think, is incredible, because they have got the next group of players coming through from this is scary, and they've shown early doors what they're about. So you can use it as an excuse for Liverpool to say they've got a lot of injuries in this, but the quality that is coming through, there's no doubt about it. They've got every chance, and they showed that against Chelsea in the League Cup.
Kwanzaa and Bradley played in League One last season. Yeah. And we know how difficult it is to make that step up from the Championship to the Premier League. Sometimes even from the Premier League, like a mid-table team to a top team. And yet from League One to the top of the Premier League, it looked like they've been there for a long time.
Do we need to talk about Erling Haaland and his performance in this game? It was very, very quiet, I was going to say, Bridget, but yeah, you can go in two-footed on him and say, did he play? To be honest, I read a match report in one of the papers in the UK on this game, which was really, really harsh, and said sometimes he looks like a competition winner playing up front for Manchester City. We're talking about the top scorer in the Premier League. We're talking about one of the greatest goal scorers we've seen in the 21st century. And yet, we still have these doubts over him.
Yeah, the goals that he scored, 5 against Luton, I think he scored 5 in the Champions League game. He is absolutely incredible. But I heard some good... There's a few radio stations I've been listening to over here in the UK, and a lot of the people ringing up saying, when are we going to see Haaland do it in a big game against a big club? And it was very interesting.
I mean, he did score in this fixture earlier this season, I think in the 1-1, he did score in that. But if you look at the number of goals he scored against two, it hasn't been against the biggest teams.
Do you know the moment in the game where his eyes lit up and it's like, you see the jackpot? He got one-on-one with Virgil van Dijk.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, this is the moment. Now, it was interesting. I watched it back because I love seeing the one-on-one situations, attackers against defenders. And I always remember defenders were told, never turn your back on the ball, always try and face the ball. Well, Virgil van Dijk turned his back on Haaland 3 times. And he went right, he went left, and he managed to still put him off. So he went against all kind of defending tactics you're told from a young age. Because he knew that if he did turn up and square up Haaland, he didn't have the pace to face his own goal. So he did so well. I think that was the moment where I thought, you know what, it is Virgil van Dijk and Kwanzaa have absolutely got Haaland tied in knots. Because that's the moment he's waiting for. And I think the rest of the game, he was just frustrated because City couldn't play out. And every time they did try, the ball was getting intercepted in front by the press. And every time they went long, the City players had all come short. So Haaland actually didn't give them an outlet. And I think Liverpool, when Haaland looks back at that, he'll probably think, you know what it is, I should have been standing in an offside position on a few occasions to try and stretch Virgil and Kwanzaa a little bit further back. I think you can definitely always improve as a striker from different areas of the game. Now, Haaland's the best finisher ever, no doubt about it. But I think you can learn a lot from playing with his back to goal, but also the moments when you can try and play a game with the defensive units. And I just think this game bypassed him as well as a lot of the other players in the front line.
It's a tough game for him, to be fair. Liverpool had more possession than City in the game, which is rare enough to be mentioned in a Premier League game or in any game for City. It's not the first time this season, but it's still really rare. And if you don't create enough chances for Haaland, we know it's very obvious, he's a finisher, this is all what he is. The rest, if you look at what Darwin does, for example, if you look at what Harry Kane does, all the other top strikers, they are involved, they do a lot of different things that Haaland doesn't do. So if you don't have that kind of creativity for him, then to be fair, when Doku hits the post, the ball is there from Haaland to Doku. So there were still moments where he made himself available. There was a good touch. But even if you look at the pass that he gave Doku before Doku hit the post, he's got his back to goal. He's falling off. The ball is still a good ball. I'm not criticizing the ball. But it clearly doesn't look natural to him. This is not what he does. Yeah. And that's why I think those games are difficult. That's why I didn't captain him on my fantasy team, for example, Kitro.
Yeah. I've got him captain permanently every single week. Are you supposed to change it?
Tremendous.
Now you tell me.
Yeah, tremendous.
Listen, okay, so
we've got to go for the biggest talking point of the game, surely.
Well, like I said, we're 13, 14 minutes into the podcast. I wanted to talk a little bit about the actual game, you know, some individual performances, some tactical analysis. And now we get to the controversy. Was there a penalty? Was there a penalty in injury time right at the end of the game for a seemingly a foul from Doku on McAllister in the penalty area. Richie, was it a penalty?
Julian, before you start, I'm going to just talk you through my moment sitting down watching the game. As the ball bounced inside the penalty area, Ndoku didn't go and head the ball. You never allow the ball to bounce inside your area. He actually bottled it. So then what happens, McAllister has the advantage here. And as the ball dropped inside the penalty box, my mum, I've gone, what the hell are you doing? Why have you let... And then McAllister comes and chests it, and then you see the foot going, touch the ball from Doku. And yet again, I'm going, you can't raise your foot in that moment. What are you doing? Yes, he won the ball, but blatantly, well, you've seen so many times this season, decisions given, you know, against one of our men, Romeo at Tottenham, Phil, when you win the ball and you go through the ball, I've seen red cards given, we've seen free kicks given. Anywhere else in the field, I agree with Klopp solely, that is a penalty. And how it wasn't given, or how I can understand how it wasn't given by the referee, but how VAR haven't asked the referee to go and have a look at it is absolutely beyond me. It's a big call. I'd be fuming if I was a Liverpool fan. Manchester City they've missed a trick and got away with one there, because that would have definitely put them 2-1 up should McAllister have scored his second penalty of the game if he'd had got up from the challenge, which he would have done, I'm sure. But yeah, penalty for me, Phil, all day long.
I mean, so the explanation from Michael Oliver was a bit what Bridget just said, that Doku got the ball first and then, okay, then he destroys McAllister's chest with his studs, but that he got the ball first. I think what he was checking with VAR was just did he get the ball first? That's what he told Klopp. Jamie Carragher on UK television said for him it was the right call, which I was a bit surprised.
Yeah, Jamie Carragher bottled it. He didn't want the backlash from Manchester City fans. Yeah. And I don't mind saying that about Jamie. He absolutely bottled it. No, he sat on the fence. He'd be a good politician.
A pen as well. Yeah, I thought it was a pen, but I can see the argument of he touched the ball first, so... But yeah, I thought it was...
But Julian, really, how many times have we seen that decision this season where a player has won the ball?
Yeah, you're right.
And the momentum has gone through and they've gone, oh, well, yes, he's won the ball, but the momentum, that is a straight red card. So if I raise my foot inside anywhere else in the field like that and I stood somebody and I go through, you're getting a free kick. So I don't know. Michael Oliver is an unbelievable referee. I think he started his journey back up in the northeast when I was coming through as well towards the back end of my career. I rate him. He's had so many big games. That was a big moment in the game, and I think he got that. He definitely got that wrong.
There's always an issue, just Kitro, before you go. There's always something about if you get to the ball first. Remember in the Manchester derby when Garnacho is through and Ederson comes and tackles the ball out? And gets the ball first, but then he's quite reckless the way he gets into Garnacho. And Ten Hag at the end said, I'm sorry, this is, for him, he said, this is a penalty. And yeah, Ederson got the ball first, but it's true that the tackle was a really hard, kind of reckless tackle. But he got the ball first, and he got out, and it was a throw-in for United, not a penalty. This time, again, you can go, Doku gets the ball first, then yeah, after that, it's reckless on McAllister's chest, no problem. So I think there's maybe something that they need to clear up in the law. It's not because you get to the ball first, that is not a foul, especially if the challenge is quite reckless.
Yeah. I'm just pleased McAllister didn't put his head down. He took it with his chest, because if he puts his head down there, he could have been facially damaged for a long time. That's the argument. That's why I think it was more dangerous.
This situation on all positions on the pitch is 100% a foul, and it's a yellow card. He hit the ball, but he can only hit the ball because his foot was right there. If the ball is not there, he kills him. It's as easy as that. It's a penalty for all football people on the planet, said Jurgen Klopp after the game. Well, I think it's difficult to disagree with him, to be honest. I thought it was a pretty clear. That was a pretty clear penalty.
What about you, Phil? You're a penalty man, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, 100%, 100%. And I can only imagine, because obviously I'm based in Spain, I work in Spanish football, and if that penalty had not been given to a big team here, we would be talking about it for decades. People would be talking about it for a very, very long time. But anyway, the penalty was not given. So, to the chances of the respective sides of winning the Premier League title... I've given Liverpool a better chance. Bridgie thinks Manchester City. Why do you think, Jules? Why do you think? We'll get to Arsenal in just a second. Why do you think that Manchester City and Liverpool will not win the Premier League title after witnessing this game?
I mean, to be fair, it was more... I thought you were going to say Liverpool, Phil, because you said it the other day when we were together on the show, and Bridgie said City, so I thought we may as well go for Arsenal. I think it's really open. What I would say is that your beloved Spurs will be the referee of this title race, of course. They still have the 3 teams to play, and they will play them back-to-back, by the way, which is going to be an incredible few days. United are also a bit of a referee. They already played City, but they still have Liverpool and Arsenal to play as well. So there will be more points dropped Yeah, Villa, I think you're right. I still also, and when you saw what Villa did to Arsenal, to City in the first half of the season, it'd be very interesting. So there will be more points dropped, I think that's for sure. I think the slight advantage that Arsenal have in the goal difference might not really count at the end of the season because there's still 10 games to go and that's a lot of footballs to be played. Mm. I just really think that it's a very tight title race. And yeah, you could think that City, because of the fact that they've won three in a row already, because it's City, because they are like relentless team towards ends of seasons, have maybe a slight advantage. You can think that Liverpool have the advantage because of where they are with all the injury that they've just had. When everybody's going to come back, which will be very soon, then they're going to be probably unstoppable. Fair enough. I also believe in this Arsenal team, this mentality. They win games late. We saw that against City. We saw that again against Brentford at the weekend. They've got that kind of momentum with them. And all their injured players are back now. Partey, Zinchenko, Gabriel Jesus, Tomiyasu is not far away either. So they will have a full squad. And especially if they get out of the Champions League on Tuesday against Porto, then they will have only the league to focus on. And that could also make a difference because City and Liverpool will go far in their competitions in Europe this season.
You've been looking at the respective run-ins, Bridgie. And yeah. Who do you think has got the easier run-in?
Well, I think City have got the easier running out of the three. Julian just touched on it there. The squad depth that you have with Arsenal and Manchester City is up there. Liverpool are on bare bones, no doubt about. But I still think they've got the quality and the trust element that they could make still have a right good go. But I've said City, right? I think City will win it because of their running. Yes, Tottenham and Villa are going to play a massive part in this. They've got to play all three teams. I really want Liverpool to win it, though, because it's Klopp's last year. The youngsters that are coming through, I would love to see them do it just for him to say farewell. I know he's already got one trophy under his belt. I would love it for him to bow out, and especially the performance they put on against City in the way that I felt that they should have had the penalty. But I just think that City, with the momentum that they have got, the easier running, the players coming back, I feel that it could be theirs. But again, I'm just delighted that we're talking about three different teams going for it and how tight it is. I think that's the joy of what is going on at this moment in time.
It's so great that we're actually talking about goal difference as well. Imagine if the Premier League title goes down to goal difference. That would be absolutely extraordinary. I think it's unprecedented, by the way, to have three teams separated by 1 point with 10 games to go in the Premier League. I think it is the tightest it's ever been. So just sit back and enjoy. Let's move on and talk about Arsenal and their 2-1 win against Brentford. They left it late once again, but Kai Havertz popped up on the 86th minute to register a massive, massive goal in Arsenal's season. Their rampant goal-scoring form came to a bit of an end here because they've been on a ridiculous run of scoring before the visit of Brentford. But they got the win. And as again, you mentioned, Jules, that spirit of scoring late goals. And we were having this argument, I think, last week on the podcast. And I was questioning the cliched narrative of like, this is what you've got to do. If you've got to win a league title, you've got to be winning late games. And I was saying, if you're relying on late goals, then actually maybe you're not that good a team. You know, teams that win league titles are maybe usually in a bit more of control of matches. But
Sir Alex Ferguson will be fuming with your comments.
Well, what does he
and
know?
Steve Bruce with all his late goals at Manchester United all them years ago. Yeah. Stop it.
Yeah, it was just a sort of an idea that floated into my head that actually if you're consistently relying on these goals, maybe you're
Fergie
not
time,
as good
won the champions, won the Premier League for Man United. Sorry, go on.
Arteta time then Jules with another late goal for Arsenal.
Yeah, I understand your point as well on late goals. I just think there are times, there are games where you may control the game, but for whatever reason, and in this game, we saw the mistake by Ramsdale. If Ramsdale doesn't make that mistake, I think Arsenal can cruise to maybe a 2-0 win, and there's no problem, and we don't talk about another late goal. But they are games, there are scenarios where it doesn't happen like that. And this case, I think there was a point where you could feel the frustration growing and growing, even within the stadium, the tension at the Emirates, because I think a lot of people thought, oh my God, we're going to drop points here against a team that we should not be dropping points against at home because of a mistake that of our substitute goalkeeper who's only playing because the number one can't face his parent team, all of that. And in the end, Kai Havertz, who have been heavily criticised, of course, at the start of the season for the transfer fee and not really delivering, who now is getting better and better. And And that was a header that maybe Flecken could have done better on. And I don't think, as Bridgie as a number nine, I think we'll agree with me that it's not a good header from Havertz. He's on the goalkeeper, but he's so close. And Flecken is not really sure that he can't save it. And in the end, this proved to be a massive goal for Arsenal in the title race.
Another goal for Kai Havertz, 8 in the league this season, drawing level with Nicholas Jackson and João Pedro. He's only one behind Elijah Adebayo at Luton as well. So if this rampant form continues, sorry, I'm talking with my Spurs hat on. But yeah, another big goal from Kai Havertz. All that, you know, it's not 60 million down the drain because he keeps scoring important goals. But it's only 8 goals this season. I mean, it's not rampant yet.
No, it's definitely not. I'm with you, Phil. I'm not a big fan of his. I've got to be honest. I wasn't a big fan of his at Chelsea. I don't see the price tag where it comes from. But that was a very, very important goal. And there was two big moments in this game. And they both came from the goalkeeper, Ramsdale. You mentioned there, what, Julian, the mistake. I'll tell you what, Tony, with this, there was a shot in the game. It would have been the goal of the season. And it was on target. It was a big looping volley from a long way out. And how he tried it is just, I mean, I know he's on the radar of several teams. And he thought, you know what it is, I'm going to give this a go. And Ramsdale pulled off that save. And a couple more big saves in that game for Arsenal to keep them in it. So he totally redeemed himself. And yeah, the way that Arsenal managed to get a game out, I'm watching that. Now, if there's anybody you're playing that concedes as many late goals in the last 15 minutes of games, you want to be playing Brentford, because they have got a nightmare in the last 15 minutes of games where they sit back. They almost seem to just go too deep once again and invite that pressure. I've watched them several times this season, and I'm never comfortable when they're always in a game by one goal or it's a draw, because they always just seem so vulnerable late on in the games. I think that's one thing that Thomas Frank is going to have to try and change going into the last few matches. You can't sit back. And I just thought it was inevitable that Arsenal were going to get something out of it, especially at home. And they didn't. It was that man Havertz that you say hasn't been incredible, but they deserved it. I thought that Arsenal played... Yeah, they weren't at their glorious best like we've seen them in the last few matches. I think... What was their last game that they... Where they absolutely... Was it Luton Town?
Sheffield United.
Sorry, Sheffield United. Yeah. I mean, you might say, oh, it's only Sheffield United. No, it doesn't matter what team it is. It was an unbelievable performance. You've still got to go and put the ball in the goal, but everything they did, I went, oh, this team are starting to tick. So, I mean, Julian said it very, very well before. They're getting all their players back. We saw Thomas Partey coming on. We've seen that. As much as I don't like saying this, I've said I want Liverpool to win it. Arsenal are in the mix, and they are finding ways to win. So they can do it dirty and ugly towards the end of games. It's a massive tick. And when they're in full flight, nobody can touch them.
Yeah, that's the thing. They've got all sorts of different ways of winning matches. They've been really beating up on the lower rated teams in the division. Big high scoring wins. And then they've actually been getting good results against the higher teams in the division as well. And speaking of those kind of fixtures, next up it's Arsenal against Manchester City in a couple of weeks' time, because there's the FA Cup next weekend. And then after that, it's against City, which is also another enormous game, Jules, and one to look forward to.
Yeah, on Easter Sunday as well, 31st of March at the Etihad, which again will be the key. I think Liverpool will find themselves in Arsenal's boots for this weekend, where they will be playing and watching the other two facing each other, hoping for a draw, I guess, which probably suit them, especially if they win on that weekend. Massive game, of course. Remember the reverse fixture at the Emirates, which was quite a cagey game, cagey affair, and then late that Martinelli shot deflected by Ake. Ake, by the way, we said made a mistake that gifted Liverpool the penalty that cost his team that goal against Arsenal as well. Not the best of season for him. But it would be fantastic, that game, and you would think that City are favourite, of course, at the Etihad. But Arsenal, I think, have the pace to trouble them for sure. They can go and press them as well. It would be tight. It would be close, but that would be another massive, massive like chapter in this incredible title race.
And just before that game, it's Liverpool against Brighton. So yeah, very similar to what we had this weekend. All right, that's enough title talk. You know, no one's that interested in the Premier League title race. Everybody's interested in the battle for fourth.
I know where you're going here.
That's the big storyline, isn't it? And it's not the big storyline, but it is an interesting storyline. And it looks like Aston Villa and Spurs are involved in a serious battle for fourth place. I think we can potentially discount Manchester United, although not mathematically. It was Villa-Spurs this weekend at Villa Park, and Spurs ran out 4-0 winners. The reverse fixture early on in the season, Villa had won 2-1 in North London, which was a game I was at, and watch Spurs spurn a hatful of chances and somehow lose that game. And I think they made up for it by being really rampant in the second half. The first half was a pretty cagey affair, guys, but then Spurs really turned it on in the second half, particularly after the pretty crazy sending off from John McGinn, Bridgie.
Yeah, it was, like you say, it came to life second half, and whatever Ange said at half-time worked. I know he'd mentioned a few of the players that were in there. He said that, you know, Villa are starting to tire. We've seen the stats. The legs are going. Just keep going. Be a bit relentless and have a go. And I think what you mentioned there for last time, squandered a lot of chances against Aston Villa, did Tottenham. This time, 7 shots, 5, you know, they were just clinical with the amount of shots that they converted from the match, with the stats that were going around. You know, there was 5 shots on target, 4 scored by Tottenham Hotspur. Villa only had 1 shot. So that was a big change for me, and the way that John McGinn, I can't think what player it was. There was 2 or 3 players around John McGinn in the background when he was getting sent off. And they all pointed at their own head, as much as say, McGinn, you've lost your head. It's the side of the game that lets McGinn down, but it's the side of the game that has made him the player that he is, because he'll go and he'll put them tackles in. But that one there was just, he completely lost his mental side of the game and let his team down because of the frustration of the way that they totally lost that, you know, the battle with possession. I mean, the passing stats, the percentage, 70%, you know, and that was just a head loss. And I saw him do it pre-season in Australia, funnily enough. Leeds United were playing Aston Villa over there, and there was a young player coming through at the age of 16, Archie Gray, who obviously we've all seen and heard about now. There's a lot of teams chasing him. He got the, you know, playing the FA Cup against Chelsea. He walked away with a man of the match against two of the most expensive players in Chelsea's history and midfielders. And I saw John McGinn snap Archie Gray really, really badly, and got there was several things said after the game from Leeds United players towards McGinn. He lost his head, and that was in a pre-season friendly. But I really rate him as a player. But yeah, that was a stupid moment that I think Unai Emery will be, you know, be absolutely devastated with. But what it basically did, Phil, it opened the door for Spurs to go and win the game and absolutely show Unai Emery up at home and give him his biggest defeat of the season. So Ange Postecoglou yet again goes on to show why he's such a wanted manager, and I'm just pleased we've got him.
John McGinn had said prior to this game, this is the biggest game in Aston Villa's recent history. So you could you could see he was up for it, and he lost it. But yeah, but then with 10 men, Spurs were already 2-0 up at that point, and they went on and scored 2 more goals in injury time. But it was a pretty strong performance, and a bit of a message sent, I think, from Spurs in this battle for top four.
They were not very good against Palace for 75 minutes. They struggled at Wolves as well in the previous game, because they could have a lot of the ball. And at times, if the creativity is not there, or if the runs are not made, or the players that made those runs not found, then maybe they struggle a bit. And in the second half, they were so perfect. I mean, the first goal, when you score 2 goals in 3 minutes to start with, when the first one is in 5 minutes after the break, that completely knocks out your opponent. And that first goal by Maddison is so key in this game. You kind of knew watching it that whoever would have scored first would have got a massive advantage in that game. And for Spurs to score that way, I mean, Pape Matar's cross is one of the best crosses that we've seen this season. And the finish is great, but really, let's be honest, Maddison, I don't know, Bridgie, if you scored any like that, but Maddison just put his legs up, hoping that he makes the good contact and the keeper doesn't get... But it's all about the cross, really. And after that, even with Van de Ven's injury, which, by the way, is the only bad news, really, for Spurs on the day, the rest after that, it was just perfect from Ange and the players.
Yeah, it's trusting the cross, Julian, like you say. If you know players are out there... I've played with some players where all they think about is just whipping that ball into an area in between the goalkeeper and the defender, because they know if the defenders are sliding back towards their goal, they might get a touch and score an own goal. It's an uncertain area for goalkeepers. So if you, as a striker, know you're going to get that delivery, he'll make the run. And I think Maddison timed it absolutely perfect. I'll play with a lot of other players that would quite happily do a Cruyff turn there and check back and try and, you know, then beat the player six and seven times, and you're in the box going, are you going to cross the blooming ball or what? So, you know, that's the trust that Spurs have and what Ange likes to play. It was a lovely move. Now, I'm going to throw one in here, lads, to use. Okay, Spurs have got a game in hand, right? 27 games played, game in hand over Aston Villa to go. If they win that game, go to 56 points. Villa will be on 55 in that fourth spot, all right? Bearing in mind that Villa and Tottenham have got all the teams in the top three to play, are we counting Villa and Tottenham out of a title challenge?
Oh no, definitely not. I think Spurs are right in it.
Yes, there you go. We've got him. I went fishing and he had a bite.
To be honest, I was actually looking at the points tally as well and having a think, like, there's 30 points left up for grabs. They're not mathematically out of it, like you said. They all play each other. I mean, I think, listen, it would be really weird if they somehow got into the title race, to be honest, Spurs.
We're talking about, is it a Champions League spot? And I'm really looking at that table thinking, I'll tell you what, if they didn't have to play them teams at the top and you didn't see, I mean, Ange Postecoglou would have been loving the fact that of what Liverpool did to Man City, because I know they're going to have a right go. He will not change. He's going to go and press and press and press. So it could go either way. It could be catastrophic or it could be a masterclass.
Jules, there's two ridiculous Spurs fans here getting carried away. Come and put some order in here. Come and bring us
no,
back.
No, I love it. I was on UK radio the other day on Five Live, and I said that you can't count out Villa and Spurs. Okay, maybe not for the title, simply because to overtake three teams, that would be incredible. But as we've said, they will be a key part of this title race, whether they're still in it, they're part of it, they are the referee of it, whatever way you want to put it. They're very much in there. And I think right now it looks like the momentum is slightly more. I know Villa had won three in a row before being smashed by Spurs, but the start of 2024 hadn't been great for Villa. To be fair, it hadn't been that great for Spurs either. But this is a massive game, because had Villa won yesterday, they would have been 8 points clear with one game in hand for Spurs still. But 8 points, I think the gap would have probably been too much. Now, it's a very, very different story. So we'll have to see. But those games that they will play against the top three, same with United, by the way, will be quite fascinating. And yeah, maybe there's a chance.
Just wanted to put it out
maybe
there we go.
Maybe. I mean, just on an individual level, from a Spurs perspective, I think the front three are playing well. I don't want to alarm anyone, but Timo Werner scored in consecutive games in the Premier League, which is almost unprecedented. I think it happened a couple of times while he was at Chelsea, but he wasn't known for going on big goal-scoring runs. He's scoring. Brennan Johnson's looking a much more dangerous player at the start of the season. Son is back and being Son and being amazing. Kulusevski was fantastic yesterday. Maddison's back from injury and looking good. So it's I'm feeding into me getting carried away again, but certainly the front of the team is looking very, very solid. And if Van de Ven can come back from injury quickly, we had Dragusin play pretty well when he came on against Villa. So overall, things are pretty positive for Spurs, and they're looking pretty good to challenge Villa right until the end for top four, if not City, Arsenal, and Liverpool for the title. But but yeah, okay. Let's park that.
Watch them lose away at Fulham then next weekend.
Watch. I mean, that would be just, you know, monumentally and inevitably Spursy. I mean, we know it's going to happen. It's true.
We know where Julian was going there. He was just bringing us back to earth. Let's move on.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah, you're right. Let's park that chat there. You've heard a bit about the intense battle at the top of the Premier League table and that fierce battle for top four as well. But here's a bit more of what to look forward to on Optus Sport.
Only three places left in UEFA Euro 2024.
Celebration in Athens.
March 22, the playoff semi-finals. Six knockout matches with some huge names in the mix.
Putting Wales in front.
Then, March 27, the playoff finals. Three games to decide the last three nations for UEFA Euro 2024. And all in time for breakfast.
Next level.
The UEFA Euro 2024 playoffs begin March 22 on Optus Sport.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Time for La Liga chat, and it was a pretty standard week in La Liga in terms of the top three all winning. Real Madrid thrashing Celta Vigo by 4-0 at the Bernabeu on Sunday evening. We also saw Barcelona win just about on Friday night. They were 1-0 winners at home against Mallorca, and Girona were pretty comfortable 2-0 victors over Osasuna. So the top three all winning. Atletico Madrid, though, continuing their bizarrely bad away home. Guys, they've got the best home record in the division, 40 points from a possible 42, and away from home, they've only picked up 15 points, 15 from a possible 42. It is absolutely bizarre. Diego Simeone was asked about it after the game, and he literally said, "I have no words. There are no words to explain this," which is quite refreshing because it's very, very difficult to know how to try and explain this. Bridget, I just wonder how, in your career, did it ever happen that you were super strong at home and just really, really poor away from home? It's difficult to get your head around.
Well, I would say it was the away form at Leeds United in 99-2000 that actually derailed our Premier League title when we were top at Christmas. We lost out to Manchester United and Arsenal in the end and finished third. And I look back at the away results and we basically, you know, couldn't beat the teams that finished above us. They seem to always have the home advantage. And when you've, you know, Thierry Henry always used to run riot against us for Arsenal. So yeah, we couldn't fathom out what was going on at that time. We travelled very well in Europe, funnily enough, when we were playing over in Russia several times in the UEFA Cup that year. Drew at Roma that year as well, beat them at home. So we travelled well, but in domestically, not very good away from home, and tried different things, travelling down on the day games instead of staying over in hotels, and sadly nothing seemed to work for that. So Simeone's going through the same thing. And I think the most disappointing thing for Simeone and the team this season is the fact that if they'd have got the better away result, they would have probably could have run away with this title.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the thing. That's the thing, because they've been so bad. We're not talking about them even having, you know, a couple of blips away from home. They've won 4 games away from home all season. They've lost 7 times away from home. And at the weekend, they lost to Cadiz, who hadn't won in 6.5 months, Jules.
That's what I was going to say. It's one thing to lose away at the Bernabeu, San Mamés, you know, in those big hostile atmospheres. To lose a Cadiz, they have won 2 games at home all season long before Sunday against Atletico. It's crazy. I think the Griezmann not being there is obviously a big thing. And we said it before, when Griezmann plays and he's good, then Atletico are good. When he's not there or doesn't play well, they clearly struggle for creativity, for leadership, for a lot of things. And that was the case again. They were really, really average. And 3 days before facing Inter in a massive Champions League game at home this time, where they've been so good, but with a 1-goal deficit from the first leg, it's really not the right preparation or rehearsal that you would want. I'm just amazed that you can go away to, again, Cadiz are not very good this season, and not show up, no. Not feel like you want to, the desire wasn't there, the energy wasn't there. I thought it was really strange, unless they already had their eyes and their minds on Inter. But then that's risky, because behind them, Athletic Club de Bilbao are just there breathing down their neck. And imagine if they don't even make the top four. Yeah.
2 points. And next weekend, we've got a massive game live on Opta Sport. It's Atletico Madrid against Barcelona at the Civitas Metropolitana. So that's a game that you absolutely should not miss. A few weeks ago, when Real Madrid beat Girona 4-0 at the Bernabeu in what we billed as being the title decider, I wrote my Opta Sport column on 5 reasons why you should still watch La Liga. And one of them was there are incredible young players in La Liga getting a chance week in, week out, and doing amazing things. And one of them is Lamine Yamal, who scored the only goal of the game for Barcelona in that 1-0 win against Mallorca. Remember, guys, this kid is just 16 years of age, and he is leading this Barcelona side. He is being the difference in a number of games. There's also a young kid at the back for Barcelona, another teenager called Pau Cubarsí, a central defender who looks absolutely the business. So this is another reason why you should be watching La Liga, guys, because in a couple of years' time, they're going to be household names. And if you're watching it on Opta Sport, you will have known about these players before and you can impress all your mates. But Jules, how good are these two teenagers?
Incredible. I mean, Lamine, especially, we've known him since a bit longer than Pau Cubarsí, who was very, very highly rated in the youth teams of Barcelona and for Spain, that a lot of top, top clubs in Europe were following him and his contract situation. Lamine was the same, but he obviously made his debut for the first team before that. And it's just outstanding. Xavi said after the game, it's unfair to compare him to Messi and everything. Of course it is. It's unfair to compare anybody, even Bridgie, with Messi. However, I think what's important... But people are. Bridgie, Messi, you know, it rhymes as well. But what's maybe the most important... You don't have to compare him with Messi. This is not the point. However, it's not because he's 16 that you can't rely on him like you could rely on a top, top, top world-class player who's much older. I mean, Messi broke into a team that was the top, top team that had Ronaldinho in and Thierry Henry in and Samuel Eto'o and obviously Xavi and Iniesta and et cetera, and Pep Guardiola as a manager not long after. This is very different for Lamine Yamal. As we saw against Mallorca, he has to do a lot of things on his own because behind him, it's not that good collectively, especially with Pedri and De Jong and Gavi and all the injuries that they have. So I've got no issue with putting more pressure on Lamine. One, I think he can take it. And two, I think he's so good that he can easily keep carrying this team until the end of the season.
It's so difficult not to get carried away when someone is this good and this young. And I think we've been mentioning it on the podcast all season, actually, to maybe try and quell expectations because he is still literally a child. But when someone is this good, it is difficult to not get carried away, Bridgie, even though they're so, so young.
It certainly is. And I love Julian mentioned me there with Messi. I've never been mentioned the same line or sentence ever before, so I appreciate that. But what I will take you back to, speaking of youngsters coming through, we're going to have a little trip down memory lane here. Yeah, right, because I found something yesterday as we knew we were going to be talking about these wonder kids in Spain. Not sure if you can see that on the screen there that I'm showing you boys there. There's a picture of myself, Michael Owen and Emil Heskey, right? We were the three up-and-coming talents of the strike force. And then the defenders, here's a one, see if you remember these boys. There was Jordi Morris, Michael Branch and Rio Ferdinand. They were the six players that were we getting talked about 20-odd years ago, actually it might even be 30 years ago now, 28 years ago, 29 years ago, for the up-and-coming talent in England. So not bad names. So the fact that we're talking about these superstars in La Liga and many more to come, you know, what I've just shown you there, we saw so many of them boys, most of them went on to play for England full squad, full cap. So looking forward to watching them. Like you say, Phil, La Liga is full of these youngsters coming through and getting a chance. And yeah, I mean, Lamine has been absolutely sensational. How many goals has he got for Barcelona now, by the way, at that age? What is it? Is he up to six or seven?
He hasn't scored in the Champions League, but I think he's scored in the Super Cup and the Copa del Rey as well. So yeah, six in total. And he's doing big things. Did no one ever call you the North Shields Messi, Bridgie?
No, I got called Messi a lot of the times, but probably when I went to functions because of my clothes, mate. I was a very, very... I didn't have a lot of class for
that. I love these like place names next to a footballer. So you heard Phil Foden get called the Stockport Iniesta quite a lot as well, which I like. I don't know if there are any others that anyone can think of off the top of their heads. But yeah, the North Shields Messi, you know.
Yeah, there's Repalo. Wasn't Repalo...
The Romford Pele, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. I mean, that's pushing it.
Yeah, Romford Pele. Yeah.
Yes, there we go. There was another youngster as well who got on the score sheet in La Liga this weekend with Arda Güler, the Turkish international, still just 19, scoring the final of Real Madrid's four goals at the Bernabeu against Celta Vigo, a player who we haven't seen much of this season because of injuries and because it's really difficult to break into the Real Madrid starting 11, but he's certainly extremely talented. He's got his first goal now, and let's see if we see him get some more minutes. Real Madrid are 7 points clear at the top of the table ahead of Girona with Barcelona in third.
Who wins it, Phil?
Well, I've been saying Real Madrid since the start of the season. I don't think there's any reason at all for me to change that now, given the gap that they have, and they just look like they're in Real Madrid mode now. They're gonna push on and win the league. I just wonder if the Champions League might be a little bit of a distraction because they really want to win that as well. The Champions League means so much for Real Madrid. So they might drop one or two points if they have some big midweek games in the Champions League and they have to rest players. They're doing all this, by the way, without their first choice goalkeeper and being decimated by injuries with the two first choice centre-backs being out all season. So that's pretty impressive, although... It is Real Madrid. They've got a very big, expensive squad, so they should be able to deal with some injuries.
Well, I'm going to upset you here. From one end of the table to the bottom, does your team survive?
Oh, you want to talk about Rio?
Go on. Oh, quickly. Goodness. Give us a little bit on Rio. Go on.
Guys, Rayo Vallecano lost at Alaves this weekend. They were absolutely appalling. And with Cádiz somehow beating Atletico Madrid, Cádiz stay in the relegation zone.
I had to bring it up, Phil. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it's fine. It's fine. They've clawed points back. So now they're just 2 points away from safety. Rayo are just 4 points away from the relegation zone. Bridgie, I know you like a bit of a wager because I told my mates about a month ago. It was literally a month ago on the 11th of February. Rayo are 34-1 to get relegated.
You did. And you told me. You give us a heads up as well.
Did I tell you as well?
Yeah, you did. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't regret getting my season ticket. It's been a wonderful experience watching Rayo play absolutely terrible football and winning only one game all season at home. But, yeah, I think they might go down. I genuinely think that the momentum is so bad.
Julian, what this means is if we see Phil next season buying a new villa somewhere exotic, we know that he had a heavy wager at his team getting relegated this season.
Listen, if they get relegated, at least the season ticket will be cheaper next season. Yeah, so there we go. They're pretty damn cheap anyway. So. I think we'll leave it there. Thanks, Bridgie, for ending the podcast on that relegation for Rio talk. But great. Thanks, Bridgie. Thanks, Julian. Remember, Optus Sport is the only place you can watch the Premier League, La Liga, J League, K League, and the WSL live, as well as the remaining European qualifiers and a stack of great internationals on the way in less than 2 weeks' time. We'll see you next week on the Optus Sport Football Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.